The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Book Club. I'm Claire Armistead, books editor of The Guardian and Observer. Our guest this month is Rose Tremain, whose first Booker shortlisted historical novel was published 23 years ago. Restoration is about a doctor and would-be courtier to Charles II, who falls tempestuously in and out of favour. It's a fair bet that a lot of people will be revisiting it right now, as she's just published a sequel, Merivale, which follows the further adventures of the gluttonous medic. Hard though it might seem to believe in the age of Hilary Mantel's Booker-winning Tudors and indeed Tremain's own Restoration romps, when she first published Restoration, historical fiction was still considered rather disreputable, as John Mullen reminded her.
It was not taken as seriously as it's taken now because there were fewer good writers doing it. But maybe I was a kind of hostage to fortune in setting the novel at the time of the Restoration, which is classic kind of what you would call flouncy bodice ripper territory. So perhaps I was inviting this thing, but it was quite interesting. I mean, the novel was quite nicely reviewed, quite kindly reviewed, but it was reviewed in an affectionate but slightly mocking way. I remember one of the headlines, I think in the Daily Mail, was Knickerbocker Glory. So it was in that spirit that the book was reviewed, as a kind of, as a romp. And, of course, there is a romp element to it, but I had a much more serious intention than that. And I think the climate in which historical fiction is now viewed, because so many sort of what we would call literary writers or serious writers have gravitated to it, it's possibly because they realise how much fun it is.
It is about lust and bawdiness and things. So the Daily Mail could get away with that. It's libido meets all sorts of other things, isn't it?
I mean, what is it? It's also materialism. Yes. And this is my start point. Sex and material goodies and flaunting what you've got. Pepys said famously when Charles II was restored, he said it was like there was suddenly an explosion, a clap of laughter exploding over England. And it was as if it was one of those extraordinary moments when in an instant history completely changed. And if one is sort of tempted to see the interregnum in slightly monochromatic colours, suddenly there was all this scarlet and gold.
Yeah.
And I thought, I want that to be the colour of those to be the colours of the book. The book has got to be absolutely of its time with the coloration of its time. But I was also trying to make a parallel about the time that we were living in, which is the end of the 1980s, which was, you know, after the 70s, which had been a very arduous decade. And here we were in the middle of Thatcher, you know, and the kind of, you know, foodie clubs were starting and people were spending a lot of money suddenly on food and going out and clothes and property. What I was very tempted to do then was to look for another period in history, and this seemed to me to be absolutely perfect, where some of the same things were happening, that all eyes were turned in the same direction, the direction of acquiring things.
Yes.
It permeated down right through society. I mean, there's an ongoing character in both books, Rosie, named after me, I think, you know, is a washerwoman. Yeah, it's my inner washerwoman talking, who notices even in the quality of the shirts that she's ironing the difference between 1660 and before. So it goes all the way through society, and I was quite keen to try and capture that.
Some of that materialism seemed to have become actually, at least for a very select group of people, the sort of official code. So there's a bit where Merivale's wife, whom of course he can't sleep with because he's only married her because she's the king's mistress, as a kind of blind to his other mistress. And she says to him, doesn't she, something like, "Have you got mistresses?" And he says, "Of course, I'm a man of my age." Mm. But that very distinctive thing that libertinism might actually be something that people profess as a way of life. Yeah. you know.
I mean, he has libertine tendencies before he's invited into the inner sanctums of Whitehall. And of course, you're in any kind of proximity to the court and to Charles's ways with all the mistresses, those tendencies are going to increase. And he can't believe what has happened to him. And suddenly it's like sort of heaven falling, you know, manna heaven falling in his lap. Women and food and dogs and everybody. So, yes, I mean, it is absolutely. And he does self-consciously all the way through the book tell you what he's feeling about these things, and that beneath all this bustle and kind of self-deception and venal behaviour, he's actually quite good at medicine. He's better at anatomy, for instance, than his rather more serious friend Pierce. But he does endlessly announce to you that he is just turned aside from serious considerations. Again and again, and even when he gets to this moment in the middle where he finds himself helping his friend with the bedlam in the fens, his behaviour is meant to alter at that point, and he tries very hard for it to do so, and then it doesn't quite alter.
So Merivale, although in your novel he has this lovely life of luxury as a courtier and he lives in a libertine manner, but there's quite a bit of God grappling as well.
Yes, the point you've made about God is quite a potent one, because I remember people saying to me when I sort of vaguely announced that I was going to set a novel in this particular time, historians would say, well, you know, the thing which is absolutely central to everybody's consciousness is God, and you must not be sort of swayed from this path. It's a very different take on morality. It's a very different take on day-to-day world, and you've got to abide by that. And I don't think I can abide by that, at least not completely. So what I have happen is that very early on in the narrative, there's this terrible fire which destroys Merivale's innocent haberdasher parents, and he is so outraged by that these dutiful, kind and sweet people could be killed in this terrible way, that sort of inflames him against God, but also finding a substitute God, which is Charles II. And this was very much sort of in my mind. I thought, well, actually, no, it isn't God which is the presence in this novel, it's the king, and he's not really the real king. I mean, nobody should read either of these novels to find a true portrait of Charles II. But he's both father, deity, king, kind of. He's the universe for Merivale.
When he's in the Fenland bedlam, the sexual relationship with the mad woman who becomes obsessed with him, Catherine, he's sort of in the confessional narrative, which is the novel, his narrative. You know, he tells us all about the sort of profane pleasure he gets of the fact that, you know, there's a kind of association, even if it's a repudiation between what he's doing with her and religion and how it's... Because she thinks that she's in the church, doesn't she?
Yes.
In the space in the church.
Yes. I think it's almost like he's testing himself. How low can he go? He says at one point that actually he thought when he was... he was banished from his house and from all the sort of material delights that he'd been experiencing, that was the lowest possible moment in his life. And then there are various other moments in the bedlam which you think, no, it's that low moment. And then finally, when he's sent away for these transgressions, that's the worst moment of all.
It's not easy for me to think of a novel of the last few decades offhand which has as many dreams in it as Restoration does.
I remember Angus Wilson saying to me, oh, dreams, Dad, never put them in. The readers will automatically skip over them. Don't ever go there. But they're metaphors, really. I mean, they're occasionally good for, again, this thing that I'm, you know, striving for all the time, which is just expanding things out. And so the dream can perhaps give, even if he himself may not understand it very well, it can give a kind of additional meaning or resonance to something which is has happened, or it may even be about to happen, or might even take us back. I love echoes. This is one of the reasons I love the novel, is that you can set something up very early on, like feeding the pack in a game of gin rummy, and then the pack gets bigger and bigger, and then you eventually snitch all the cards. But you can feed in something and then have it echo miles down the line, and you know that probably 90% of the readers won't remember it enough for that echo to be meaningful. But it makes the composite whole kind of more satisfactory in of itself, I think.
It's a kind of fun thing, isn't it? Also, you can do fun thing, interesting thing you can do with historical fiction, because if anybody has a dream in a novel after 1900, they've got a whole apparatus to sort of interpret it, haven't they?
Yeah.
Whereas the sort of the holy Quakers who look after the lunatics in the Fens sit earnestly discussing dreams, don't they? And they actually say there are three sorts of dreams, one kind being caused by the business of the day, another being the whisperings of Satan, and a third kind being true conversations between God and man. So you've got this kind of great thing that you can give him dreams, and those are the only those are the only three dreams he thinks, you know, and he doesn't think, oh yeah, well actually it's all about your infantile sexuality, and he's got none of that.
No, he's got nothing to work with. He just has to try and stumble through what they might mean in his own rather sort of obtuse way. And occasionally he does. Occasionally he sort of sees later on. I mean, the king appears in a lot of his dreams.
Yeah.
He says sort of absolutely sort of incomprehensible things. But occasionally later on he thinks, ah, oh, perhaps he meant that. And that's what I should have done and I didn't do it.
The fact that he has no reason, in a way, not to be honest about his sins...
Yeah. Yeah.
Makes him kind of rather, I'm not sure exactly likeable, but draws you in to the truth about himself.
I think this is also, I mean, a major question for me is that really is where the level at which the humour resides. And I think these books would be nothing without the humour. That we do laugh. We laugh with him sometimes. We laugh at him a lot of the time. But he does have a capacity which I very much admire in people. And actually, my mother had it to some tune. Which is that when things got really terrible, she could really often see the very funny side of things.
Maybe I could quickly ask you about the ending. The ending, yes?
The ending of Restoration.
Yeah, well, a particular question about it, because it strikes me, get back to where we started, the title Restoration, it feels as if Restoration is also a description of the shape of the narrative, I suppose.
Yes.
And that this is something you quite...
Yes, it's sort of sickle-shaped.
Yeah.
I worked out the other day, actually, that all my books have this same shape. But I think I'm writing something completely different.
Well, you start good, go down into the depths, and then get rewarded for your pains.
Yeah. So it's a sort of inevitable shape that I followed. But, I mean, there's certain images which inform the ending, notably the room, the tower, the white room that he can't make sense of. At one point, the house is very important to Merivale. This house of his in Norfolk, which he's decorated in this impossibly gaudy style with sort of... extremely expensive furnishings in clashing colours and lots of pewter and gold.
Did you have a particular Des Res in... Is this a particular sort of Norfolk estate agent kind
The Blickling
of?
Hall is,
oh,
is,
right, okay.
is the colour and shape of it. Blickling Hall has... probably people here know Blickling Hall. It has four towers.
Yeah.
And it's high Jacobean. And at the very end, Merivale makes his way up into the West Tower... And whereas all the rest of the house is sort of been subjected to these incredibly gaudy colours and bling, this is an empty space. And it's very beautiful because it's getting light from both east, it's square, it's getting east-west light. But it's completely empty and white, and it's just sort of filled with light. And the sort of metaphor that he has for it, and I think that because I didn't want to, you know, plonk the metaphor in at the end, I think it's been one that readers have found difficult to seize, that the house is sort of like his body, anatomized, that it's all sort of chaos, maybe chaos below, ascending a bit, you know, to his stomach and eventually to his heart, which is, again, is a bit chaotic area. And he never really gets up into his head until the end. And so it was a kind of metaphorical sort of ascension up into this white space that he can't, of course, really make sense of, but he nevertheless finds it very beautiful. And I suppose that within that image, which completely worked for me, there were possibly even there, even though I pushed them away for a long time, there were the seeds of another book.
Okay, great. Your chance.
You've talked about the ironing of shirts, and we've got a wonderful picture there of sort of regal robes. I wondered if you could talk a bit about the texture of materials, which seems to play a really big part in your imagination.
Well, I think it all stems from the domestic science lessons I had at school. We had to make our own. We had to make our own dresses. No, I mean, I quite like the idea of this very sense. I mean, and men don't. It seems to me in our modern age, men don't pay very much attention to what is adorning them. Compared to how the attention that they paid to them in the 17th century. And actually, when one looks at 17th century fashion, in a way, the men's kit is more beautiful than the women's. Particularly the quality of the wigs, the lace, this fantastic sort of waterfall of lace that men went around wearing, and the velvet and the frogging. It really is very beautiful. And I think that... I don't know. I suppose I just felt on his behalf that once he had money, this was one of the things that he would spend it on, fabric, which is slightly sort of perhaps his feminine side. I don't know, but it seemed to be entirely consistent with his sensual nature.
After yes. John Pierce died, Merivale has one of his reflective moments. And he thinks that there are only two people he'd really ever loved. One was the king, and the other was Pierce. Would you like to comment a bit more on that? Because I found that very interesting, the two parts of him, perhaps, that were always in conflict.
Absolutely. That is absolutely central to it. That Pierce, his Quaker friend, who is sort of a kind of manifestation of devotion to duty and work, and he's clever, he's a Quaker, he's very severe. He chastises Merivale all the time for not being good enough. And there are only one or two things like anatomy, which Merivale is better than him. And the minute he sees Merivale caught up in this court life, he is absolutely aghast. I mean, he sort of falls off his mule with aghastness. he faints at the colours of the room that he has to sleep in. So he is the kind of, he's implacable. He is duty, he is care, he is friendship, he is devotion to work, he's all the kind of things that Merivale once aspired to be as a student at Cambridge. Even then, Pierce said you weren't very good, they used to go fishing together, and he says that you weren't very good at it, you were too restless, disturbed the fish, you were too noisy. So that's one pole, and then the king, who represents all the antitheses of that, is at the other. And this tug between these two male friends was absolutely fascinating to me. And what was quite interesting is that when I conceived Restoration, I thought, well, by the end of the book, what will have happened is that he will have renounced his flirtation with the Stuarts and the fleshly paradise of Whitehall, and he will return to be a good doctor and a loyal friend to Pierce and so on, and he will be a transformed man. And it was very manifest to me about a third of the way through writing this book that was never going to happen. I hadn't written the character who could do that. And I think this raises quite an interesting question about how novels happen and what the development of characters might turn out to be. I mean, this old cliche which says, oh, is it true that, at some point the characters take over? My own version of that is it isn't that they take over. It's that by the time you've got to a certain point in the novel, perhaps, say, I don't know, 50, 100 pages into it, you understand who they are and what they are capable of. They have a kind of integrity which then, for the rest of the book, has to be honoured. And you don't really have that, however good your planning has been. You don't have that so completely at the very beginning. So sometimes, and this is why I said rather flippantly at the beginning that I never know what an ending is going to be, it is for that very reason that the character at the very beginning of a novel, it doesn't exist. He, she is just a sort of a dream in your head, but doesn't have a real sort of corporeal or even a kind of mental existence. But after a certain number of pages, he does. And you have to make a decision at that point about what the future is going to be. And it was absolutely manifest to me that I had created somebody who would try to do what I had planned for him to do. He would try very, very hard to do it, actually, and never give up. But he, in the end, he can't do it. And that was, I was rather relieved to discover, well, he can't do it. That's interesting, he can't do it. And that just, I mean, just a little bracket on the end, is that it's that thing that you have lighted on, this polarity between these two sort of pillars in Merivale's life that the story is about, this tug between these two parts of his nature. And it was that which the film of this book totally failed to recognise. They turned this story into a romance. I mean, there is, at the centre of this, there is Celia, the woman about whom they quarrel. But it's not a romance. And it was their failure to understand the logic of this polarity which made the film lose its way.
Hi, I just wanted to ask, talking about how long it's been from Restoration to your new book, how did you feel going kind of back to it? And then I suppose also, are you going to go back again?
Trilogies are respectable now. They're very, very respectable.
Somebody said to me rather desperately in a chat the other day, well, couldn't you write about Margaret? You know, could we have another book? No, going back was wonderful. I mean, I think I've been resisting doing it for kind of obvious reasons. As I think John would concur that the idea of the sequel is probably quite a dangerous one. That the sequel, you know, is almost by its nature doomed to be less good than the first book, unless you can feel fairly certain that it's going to be at least as good, if not better, than the first book. It's very foolish to embark on it. But I have thought for some years, maybe not ever since I finished The Restoration, but for maybe sort of 9 or 10 years, I have thought that there was a kind of a call to me from Merivale. And this isn't, I mean, that sounds a totally sentimental thing to say, that the character was kind of calling to me. But what was actually calling to me was the delight of inhabiting that voice again. Friends will know that I occasionally used to write little letters or notes or emails in the Merivale voice, you know, just to say things which were perhaps unsayable in any normal language. And then I thought, well, actually, if so many years have passed now, I mean, two crucial things happened to make me think that now is the moment to do it. Not just that Merivale has got 16 years older, but I have got 23 years older. I'm no longer the same person at all that I was when I wrote Restoration. I thought, well, that's interesting, because he's at a completely different bit of his life, and so am I. And let's explore what is still possible at this age in my life. I mean, he's only 56, but 56 would have been more like, you know, the age that I am now. And so he would have asked these end questions. Mm. What do you do with the last third of your life? And this is a subject that I've been very interested in, explored in my last book, Trespass. I'm very, very interested in that. What is still possible? What gives your life meaning? And so on. So there was that. And then I thought, well, actually, if that brings us neatly to 1683, with 2 years left to go between the beginning of the narrative and the death of the king, that also makes it a really interesting time. Because gone are the splendours of the Restoration, gone is all that optimism and sort of explosion of colour and so on. These are much more stringent times. The king has ruled without Parliament for several years. The coffers are empty. There's a lot of poverty. The gap between rich and poor, as Lady here was mentioning, is far greater. So it's a kind of credit crunch moment. with also uncertainty hanging over it. I mean, I think the people of England were genuinely paranoid about what was going to happen.
Definitely, yeah.
With the death of Charles II, because there was no heir. They knew they were getting James, his brother James, who was the Catholic, and that the whole kind of ethos in England was going to change. So I thought, well, go on, you know, I'm older, we can explore Merivale in a different way. The times have changed, so that makes it relevant. So I went along to my lovely editor, who is here somewhere, and I thought she'd say, no, don't do it on any account. And delightedly, she said, yes, do it. So I've done it.
And I think it's a wonderful romp, but it's also, on various levels, quite serious. And it seems to me that Merivale is looking for some salvation and redemption as he travels the life's path. Did you have any of spiritual content when you were writing this?
Well, I'm not a very spiritual person. I'm not a believer. I think the nearest I can get to spirituality is a sort of belief in goodness, that I believe that goodness and kindness is what we should strive for, and where I see goodness and kindness in people, and particularly empathy, this great thing that writers cannot do without, that question of imagining what it's like to be somebody else and to have their lives. And I think this is kind of, in the absence of any direct sort of belief in divine intervention, this is as near as I get to kind of believing in something, which is to believe in the power of empathy and thus in the power of the imagination. And that I think if I had not been able to be a writer, I suspect that my life would have been very difficult in ways that I can't quite imagine. But this... these particular things, I mean, there are other things, obviously, have kept me thinking, kept me inquiring, kept me looking. Somebody said to me the other day, you don't miss anything, do you? And I thought, well, you know, maybe that's a criticism. But actually, it's kept me very alert. And unlike Merivale, you know, do not sleep. But I could see, and I think the reader sees, amid all the chaos, and you sort of touched on it, that Merivale has a very good heart, actually. He has fantastic compassion for people who are poor and suffering. I mean, just one tiny example is his compassion for Will, his servant. The new book opens when they're all, you know, 16 years old or so. Poor old Will is nearly kind of... he can't really serve the dinner, you know. Merivale can't bear to let him go. This is one of the sort of conundrums that opens the book. What is he to do with Will? So he has a very, very kind heart. And I felt that if there was any chance of sort of salvation for him, this is where it lay, in his goodness.
Guardian Holiday Offers is pleased to bring you a great selection of worldwide trips from our trusted partners. From cultural tours and adventure holidays to river cruises and cottage breaks, we have something for everyone. To find your perfect break, go to guardian.co.uk/travel with us. That's guardian.co.uk/travel with us.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.